Chapter 32. Careworn clergymen gathered together in that vast reading room, cabbaging sermons for Sunday. You will pardon my referring to these things. Everything in this monster city interests me, and I cannot keep from talking, even at the risk of being instructive. People here seem always to express distances by parables. To a stranger it is just a little confusing to be so parabolic, so to speak. I collar a citizen, and I think I am going to get some valuable information out of him. I ask him how far it is to Birmingham, and he says it is 21 shillings and 6 pence. Now we know that doesn't help a man who is trying to learn. I find myself downtown somewhere, and I want to get some sort of idea where I am being usually lost when alone, and I stop a citizen and say, "How far is it to Charing Cross?" "He'll infer in a cab," and off he goes. I suppose if I were to ask a Londoner how far it is from the sublime to the ridiculous, he would try to express it in coin. But I am trespassing upon your time with these geological statistics and historical reflections. I will not longer keep you from your orgies. 'Tis a real pleasure for me to be here, and I thank you for it. The name of the Savage Club is associated in my mind with the kindly interest and the friendly offices which you lavished upon an old friend of mine who came among you a stranger, and you opened your English hearts to him and gave him welcome and a home Artemis Ward. Asking that you will join me, I give you his memory. Princeton, Mr. Clemens spent several days in May, 1901, in Princeton, New Jersey, as the guest of Lawrence Hutton. He gave a reading one evening before a large audience composed of university students and professors. Before the reading, Mr. Clemens said, "I feel exceedingly surreptitious in coming down here without an announcement of any kind. I do not want to see any advertisements around, for the reason that I'm not a lecturer any longer. I reformed long ago, and I break over and commit this sin only just one time this year. And that is moderate, I think, for a person of my disposition. It is not my purpose to lecture anymore, as long as I live. I never intend to stand up on a platform anymore unless by the request of a sheriff or something like that." The Street Louis Harbor Boat Arc Twain, the Countess de Rochambeau, christened the St. Louis Harbor Boat Mark Twain in honor of Mr. Clemens, June 6, 1902. Just before the luncheon he acted as pilot. "Oar away, lead," boomed out the voice of the pilot. "Arc Twain, quarter 5 1/2 6 feet," replied the leadsman below. "We are all dead safe, as long as I have the wheel, but this is my last time at the wheel." At the luncheon Mr. Clemens made a short address. "First of all, no, second of all, I wish to offer my thanks for the honor done me by naming this last rose of summer of the Mississippi Valley for me, this boat which represents a perished interest, which I fortified long ago, but did not save its life. And, in the first place, I wish to thank the Countess de Rochambeau for the honor she has done me in presiding at this christening. I believe that it is peculiarly appropriate that I should be allowed the privilege of joining my voice with the general voice of St. Louis and Miss Sourie in welcoming to the Mississippi Valley and this part of the continent these illustrious visitors from France. When La Salle came down this river a century and a quarter ago, there was nothing on its banks but savages. He opened up this great river, and by his simple act, was gathered in this great Louisiana territory. I would have done it myself for half the money." 70th birthday, address at a dinner given by Colonel George Harvey at Delmonico's, December 5, 1905. To celebrate the 70th anniversary of Mr. Clemens' birth, Mr. Howells introduced Mr. Clemens. "Oh, ladies and gentlemen, and Colonel Harvey, I will try not to be greedy on your behalf in wishing the health of our honored, and, in view of his great age, our revered guest. I will not say, 'O King, live forever!' but 'O King, live as long as you like.' Apostrophe amid great applause and waving of napkins, all rise and drink to Mark Twain.
Well, if I made that joke, it is the best one I ever made, and it is in the prettiest language too. I never can get quite to that height. But I appreciate that joke, and I shall remember it and I shall use it when occasion requires. I have had a great many birthdays in my time. I remember the first one very well, and I always think of it with indignation. Everything was so crude, unaesthetic, primeval. Nothing like this at all. No proper appreciative preparation made. Nothing really ready. Now, for a person born with high and delicate instincts, why, even the cradle wasn't whitewashed, nothing ready at all. I hadn't any hair, I hadn't any teeth, I hadn't any clothes, I had to go to my first banquet just like that. Well, everybody came swarming in. It was the merest little bit of a village, hardly that, just a little hamlet, in the backwoods of Missouri, where nothing ever happened, and the people were all interested, and they all came. They looked me over to see if there was anything fresh in my line. Why, nothing ever happened in that village. I was the only thing that had really happened there for months and months and months. And although I say it myself that shouldn't, I came the nearest to being a real event that had happened in that village in more than 2 years. Well, those people came. They came with that curiosity which is so provincial, with that frankness which also is so provincial, and they examined me all around, and gave their opinion. Nobody asked them, and I shouldn't have minded if anybody had paid me a compliment, but nobody did. Their opinions were all just green with prejudice, and I feel those opinions to this day. Well, I stood that, as long as, well, you know I was born courteous, and I stood it to the limit. I stood it an hour, and then the worm turned. I was the worm, it was my turn to turn, and I turned. I knew very well the strength of my position. I knew that I was the only spotlessly pure and innocent person in that whole town, and I came out and said so. And they could not say a word. It was so true. They blushed, they were embarrassed. Well, that was the first after-dinner speech I ever made. I think it was after dinner. It's a long stretch between that first birthday speech and this one. That was my cradle song, and this is my swan song, I suppose. I am used to swan songs. I have sung them several times. This is my 70th birthday, and I wonder if you all rise to the size of that proposition, realizing all the significance of that phrase, 70th birthday. The 70th birthday. It is the time of life when you arrive at a new and awful dignity, when you may throw aside the decent reserves which have oppressed you for a generation and stand unafraid and unabashed upon your 7-terraced summit and look down and teach unrebuked. You can tell the world how you got there. It is what they all do. You shall never get tired of telling by what delicate arts and deep moralities you climbed up to that great place. You will explain the process and dwell on the particulars with senile rapture. I have been anxious to explain my own system this long time, and now at last I have the right. I have achieved my 70 years in the usual way, by sticking strictly to a scheme of life which would kill anybody else. It sounds like an exaggeration, but that is really the common rule for attaining to old age. When we examine the program of any of these garrulous old people, we always find that the habits which have preserved them would have decayed us, that the way of life which enabled them to live upon the property of their heirs so long, as Mr. Choate says, would have put us out of commission ahead of time. I will offer here, as a sound maxim, this, that we can't reach old age by another man's road. I will now teach, offering my way of life, to whomsoever desires to commit suicide by the scheme which has enabled me to beat the doctor and the hangman for 70 years. Some of the details may sound untrue, but they are not. I am not here to deceive, I am here to teach. We have no permanent habits until we are 40. Then they begin to harden, presently they petrify, then business begins. Since 40 I have been regular about going to bed and getting up, and that is one of the main things. I have made it a rule to go to bed when there wasn't anybody left to sit up with, and I have made it a rule to get up when I had to. This has resulted in an unswerving regularity of irregularity. It has saved me sound, but it would injure another person. In the matter of diet, which is another main thing, I have been persistently strict in sticking to the things which didn't agree with me until one or the other of us got the best of it. Until lately I got the best of it myself. But last spring I stopped frolicking with mince pie after midnight. Up to then I had always believed it wasn't loaded. For 30 years I have taken coffee and bread at 8 in the morning, and no bite nor sup until 7:30 in the evening. 11 hours. That is all right for me, and is wholesome, because I have never had a headache in my life, but head achy people would not reach 70 comfortably by that road, and they would be foolish to try it. And I wish to urge upon you this, which I think is wisdom, that if you find you can't make 70 by any but an uncomfortable road, don't you go. When they take off the Pullman and retire you to the rancid smoker, put on your things, count your checks, and get out at the first way station where there's a cemetery. I have made it a rule never to smoke more than one cigar at a time. I have no other restriction as regards smoking. I do not know, just when I began to smoke, I only know that it was in my father's lifetime, and that I was discreet. He passed from this life early in 1847, when I was a shade past 11. Ever since then I have smoked publicly. As an example to others, and not that I care for moderation myself, it has always been my rule never to smoke when asleep, and never to refrain when awake. It is a good rule. I mean, for me, but some of you know quite well that it wouldn't answer for everybody that's trying to get to be 70. I smoke in bed until I have to go to sleep. I wake up in the night, sometimes once, sometimes twice, sometimes three times, and I never waste any of these opportunities to smoke. This habit is so old, and dear and precious to me, that I would feel as you, sir, would feel if you should lose the only moral you've got, meaning the chairman, if you've got one. I am making no charges. I will grant, here, that I have stopped smoking now and then, for a few months at a time, but it was not on principle, it was only to show off. It was to pulverize those critics who said I was a slave to my habits, and couldn't break my bonds. Today it is all of 60 years since I began to smoke the limit. I have never bought cigars with life belts around them. I early found that those were too expensive for me. I have always bought cheap cigars, reasonably cheap, at any rate. 60 years ago they cost me $4 a barrel, but my taste has improved, latterly, and I pay 7 now. 6 or 7. 7, I think. Yes. It's 7. But that includes the barrel. I often have smoking parties at my house, but the people that come have always just taken the pledge. I wonder why that is? As for drinking, I have no rule about that. When the others drink I like to help, otherwise I remain dry, by habit and preference. This dryness does not hurt me, but it could easily hurt you, because you are different. You let it alone. Since I was 7 years old I have seldom take a dose of medicine, and have still seldomer needed one. But up to 7 I lived exclusively on allopathic medicines. Not that I needed them, for I don't think I did. It was for economy. My father took a drugstore for a debt, and it made cod liver oil cheaper than the other breakfast foods. We had 9 barrels of it, and it lasted me 7 years. Then I was weaned. The rest of the family had to get along with rhubarb and ipecac and such things, because I was the pet. I was the first Standard Oil Trust. I had it all. By the time the drugstore was exhausted my health was established, and there has never been much the matter with me since. But you know very well it would be foolish for the average child to start for 70 on that basis. It happened to be just the thing for me, but that was merely an accident. It couldn't happen again in a century. I have never taken any exercise, except sleeping and resting, and I never intend to take any. Exercise is loathsome. And it cannot be any benefit when you are tired, and I was always tired. But let another person try my way, and see where he will come out. I desire now to repeat and emphasize that maxim. We can't reach old age by another man's road. My habits protect my life, but they would assassinate you. I have lived a severely moral life. But it would be a mistake for other people to try that, or for me to recommend it. Very few would succeed. You have to have a perfectly colossal stock of morals, and you can't get them on a margin. You have to have the whole thing, and put them in your box. Morals are an acquirement like music, like a foreign language, like piety, poker, paralysis. No man is born with them. I wasn't myself, I started poor. I hadn't a single moral. There is hardly a man in this house that is poorer than I was then. Yes, I started like that, the world before me, not a moral in this lot. Not even an insurance moral. I can remember the first one I ever got. I can remember the landscape, the weather, I can remember how everything looked. It was an old moral, an old second-hand moral, all out of repair, and didn't fit, anyway. But if you are careful with a thing like that, and keep it in a dry place, and save it for processions, and Chautauquas, and world's fairs, and so on, and disinfect it now and then, and give it a fresh coat of whitewash once in a while, you will be surprised to see how well she will last, and how long she will keep sweet, or at least inoffensive. When I got that moldy old moral, she had stopped growing, because she hadn't any exercise. But I worked her hard, I worked her Sundays and all. Under this cultivation she waxed in might, and stature beyond belief, and served me well, and was my pride and joy for 63 years. Then she got to associating with insurance presidents, and lost flesh and character, and was a sorrow to look at, and no longer competent for business. She was a great loss to me. Yet not all loss. I sold her a pathetic skeleton, as she was. I sold her to Leopold, the pirate king of Belgium. He sold her to our Metropolitan Museum, and it was very glad to get her, for without a rag on, she stands 57 feet long and 16 feet high, and they think she's a brontosaur. Well, she looks it. They believe it will take 19 geological periods to breed her match. Morals are of inestimable value, for every man is born crammed with sin microbes, and the only thing that can extirpate these sin microbes is morals. Now you take a sterilized Christian, you take the sterilized Christian, for there's only one. Dear sir, I wish you wouldn't look at me like that. 70 years. It is the scriptural statute of limitations. After that, you owe no active duties. For you the strenuous life is over. You are a time-expired man, to use Kipling's military phrase. You have served your term, well or less well, and you are mustered out. You are become an honorary member of the Republic. You are emancipated. Compulsions are not for you, nor any bugle tale but it's out. You pay the time-worn duty bills if you choose, or decline if you prefer, and without prejudice, for they are not legally collectible. The previous engagement plea, which in 40 years has cost you so many tinges, you can lay aside forever. On this side of the grave you will never need it again. If you shrink at thought of night, and winter, and... Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.